It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk Wilbert. Good morning, Casey. Another fine Saturday.
Exactly.
How are you enjoying the weather?
Oh, it's just wonderful.
Just peachy.
Love it. Love it. Well, Kirk, I want to talk a little bit about incentivized testimony, and that may sound like a term of art that we use in the legal world, but there's reasons for it. And there's a very sad story, by the way, that the Wisconsin State Journal featured this week about a man who spent time in prison for a crime he apparently did not commit. And it just starts in his third round of questioning. Sammy Hathaway confessed after being held in a Milwaukee jail for several days in 1995. He told detectives that his friend, Shante Ott, raped and murdered Jessica Payne, who was a 16-year-old runaway. Now, Hathaway has cerebral palsy, epilepsy, and brain damage, and is referred to in medical records as a poor historian. And they said that he robbed Payne before Ott raped and killed her. But the confession was all a lie. Hathaway now says that he told police this lie to avoid a homicide conviction that could have landed him behind bars for life. He says, and I quote, "I was like, okay, he did it, and I repeated the story police told me." He's now 38 years old. Now, based largely on Hathaway's testimony and that of another informant who avoided prosecution, this jury convicted Ott in 1996 of first-degree intentional homicide. He was sentenced to life in prison. As part of a deal, Hathaway pleaded guilty to robbery, and he received a five-year prison sentence. Now, this case, there was apparently DNA evidence, but they didn't ever test it. They later tested the DNA evidence, and with the help of the Wisconsin Innocence Project, another man matched this DNA evidence, and both Ott and Hathaway were exonerated, essentially. Maybe that's not the right term, but they were, you know, found not to have been a match. And so in Wisconsin, we really have no protections when it comes to incentivized testimony of witnesses, whereas in other states, there actually is protection. Now, this was a case where Hathaway, you might think, how could he have confessed to a crime that he did not commit? Well, he was coerced, essentially, and he believed that if he didn't confess, that he may be convicted of first-degree murder. And so in other states, some other states provide that you cannot be convicted based solely on the testimony of an incentivized witness or an accomplice unless there's corroboration from other evidence in the trial. And the reason for that is because they recognize that people who are often referred to as snitches may not tell the truth. They may have other motives for saying what they're saying. They may exaggerate their testimony. And so now we have a guy who spent years in prison for a crime he did not commit. And the guy who was convicted of first-degree murder spent, I believe, more than 10 years in prison for a crime he did not commit.
Well, in the federal system, we have a rule that says if there is a statement of a co-conspirator, as you've already pointed out, there is a requirement that there be some other independent form of corroboration. Evidence. It doesn't need to be all that strong, but it needs to have some form of corroboration. Another rule that isn't always followed here in Wisconsin, which is something that's applied in other jurisdictions, is the idea that one's confession cannot solely form the basis of a conviction. There should be corroboration of a confession as well. We don't have any hard and fast rule as it relates to those types of things. And those rules are designed to prevent precisely this type of scenario. But here we have an example of, and traditionally, Wisconsin has taken the approach that juries are smart, juries get it right, juries can figure out who's lying and who isn't. And if someone says something they didn't mean, they have every opportunity to get on the stand and explain, oh, that's not what I meant, or I was lying. As a way of sort of opening the floodgates to any kind of evidence of any kind coming in. But you know what's particularly problematic about this type of situation, Casey, is that we have a combination of training programs that are paid for with our tax dollars, and where law enforcement officials and detectives are sent to basically interrogation school. It starts at many of the police academies and works its way up with more specialized courses. And there are ways of psychologically manipulating people. And you combine this with the fact that we have case law. And when I say case law, as we always talk about on the show, we're referring to a court of appeals decision or a Supreme Court decision or maybe even the Supreme Court of the United States or one of the federal circuit courts that renders an opinion about a particular fact scenario, that then instructs the lower courts on how to rule. And we call it precedent, okay? So we have many, many examples over the years of manipulative police tactics being approved and authorized. For example, the police are allowed to lie to someone they're questioning. There's nothing wrong with that. Secondly, police are allowed to apply pressure, psychological pressure, to a certain extent. If it turns into something where a reviewing court who wasn't there in the interview room and doesn't and is not sitting in the shoes of somebody who is being accused of something very serious or being given an opportunity to cut their losses and cop to something less serious in exchange for pointing the finger at someone else, we have scenarios where the courts try to imagine what that must have been like. Fortunately, nowadays, we do have much more prevalence in the area of recorded statements. And that helps because we can then analyze exactly what happened, exactly what was said, the timing of statements, and whether there was this suggestive procedure that was used. But I believe what happened in this case is a very good example of a common practice whereby the police will tell the witness what they believed happened. And then the willingness of that witness to agree with that proposition, we then transform it into a so-called confession.
Right. Although, this is the statement they made, although it was the police.
Although it really wasn't the statement the person made. And we've seen cases where the so-called confession is something as simple as a person being silent and thinking about what the correct response should be, and then giving a non-committal answer. And because the police will put it in their report that we suggested to Mr. So-and-so, you know, that this is what happened and he didn't deny it, you know, that kind of thing. And we see a lot of these police practices that, and it's not because police are bad, they're not, but they're trained that a lot of this stuff is okay. And it's based on
the Reed technique.
The Reed technique. Yeah. And the Reed technique is a specific method by which all law enforcement officers are trained. They may not call it the Reed technique in every course that's attended, but the idea is to maximize the amount of psychological and emotional stress on the person. It includes such elements as where the person is positioned in the room, where the interrogator is positioned in the room, and then a series of steps whereby there's an attempt to win the person's trust. Then there's the attempt to confront the person with facts they can't deny. Then there's the attempt to expand upon those facts to push the person into admitting more. The primary presumption by utilizing the Reed technique is that the person who's sitting in that room with the interrogator is guilty. And they train people. You must assume this person is guilty, and your goal is to get them to say so. And they utilize many, many, many methods that are approved by our courts. Another thing is the old aim high but light low method, whereby you can lie to the suspect and say, Joe Schmo next door says that you're the trigger man, but we don't believe him, and we want your help. And the person ends up admitting to being on the scene or being an accomplice in some way or hiding evidence or obstructing or whatever the case may be. And unbeknownst to the so-called confessor, they're chomping at the carrot that's being put in front of his face with an attempt to deal with a difficult situation. Now, there's another thing about all of this that bothers me, and it's more of a moral issue. And see if you can follow me here, Casey. I would like to live in a society where I trust the police. I would like to live in a society where I don't walk down the street fearing that I'm going to be accused of something I have not done. I would like to live in a society where we trust the system. And every person that goes through something like this is another member of our society who has no reason to trust that things will work out the way they should. And it's blind faith in a system that we have example upon example of it not working the way that it should.
Well, and if you speak about that, perjury or false accusations were a factor in 17 out of 31 exonerations in Wisconsin since 1989, according to the National Registry of Exonerations. Incentivized witnesses, according to this story, were a factor in 45% of wrongful convictions in death penalty cases nationwide between 1973 and 2005. That's according to Northwestern University's Center on Wrongful Convictions. So this is a big problem. This is a problem that goes on, especially when you look at the fact that this individual had certain health conditions that made it apparently difficult for him to remember things. I mean, he wasn't maybe thinking 100% clearly when he made these statements. And you may wonder, well, okay, so he says this is a false confession. How do we know that? Well, we know that because we also have DNA evidence that matched up with another guy. We don't always have that, but we do in this case. And so this is yet another example of something that destroyed a person's life. And by the way, the guy Ott spent more than 12 years in prison. You know how much he got in terms of money from the state? $25,000.
Because that was the cap.
That was the cap, over 12 years.
So, we have to take a break, Casey, but I'd like to talk about this a little bit more when we get back because it's an important topic, and we're going to be interrupted momentarily by our sponsors. We'll be right back with Legal Defense.
Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. And of those two that I just mentioned, I happen to be Kirk.
And I'm Casey.
All right, Casey. We were just talking about a recent case that was reported earlier this week in the Wisconsin State Journal regarding a man that was wrongfully spent many years behind bars based on what we now know to be a false confession. The only other comment I wanted to add to this discussion, Casey, is that we have times where I've seen it many times, and I think this is another perfect example of where somebody is in a situation where we would all be led to believe that anytime someone's interrogated, the goal is for the person to acknowledge their own self-interest in self-incrimination. You know, that comes right out of the Constitution that one cannot be required to be a witness against himself if he doesn't choose to be. And in many ways, I've thought of this as a challenge that hasn't really been fully developed as I've seen it over the years, but the Miranda warnings do some of that. Okay, they put somebody on notice that what you're about to say can be used against you. But what Miranda doesn't address is the fact that those warnings can be given in such a way that they are considered to be a formality. And the police explain it that way sometimes. This is just something we have to get out of the way.
Exactly.
We'd like to hear your side of the story, and this is your chance to tell us.
Well, you know, this legal
Says we have to do this first, so let's just get this out of the way. And I've also seen, and I know you have too, trickery that occurs in that process. For example, a case where somebody says, I'm going to read these to you, and I need you to sign here indicating, confirming that I've informed you of these rights.
Right.
And then when the person signs, they just jump right into questioning without asking the all-important question, are you waiving these rights? But getting back to what a person perceives in this type of scenario, what we don't fully contemplate when we're reviewing this with 2020 hindsight, the Monday morning quarterbacking of these scenarios, is that not everyone who's being interrogated by the police believe that the police are after the truth. And if the police start suggesting things and saying, you can help us and we're going to help you, it's natural for somebody, especially if the person's not particularly intelligent, or just as bad if the person's watched a heck of a lot of television and is an addict of shows like Well, name one. I don't even watch them, but Law and Order. How about Law and Order? Right. Oh, but I have seen a couple episodes of that. I try to avoid it just because, you know, when you go home from
work,
it feels like work. It absolutely does. And not only that, but the episodes I have seen, you know, I'm always jumping up and down saying, that's not right. That's not how you do things. And I'm also amazed at how many times you see defense lawyers allowing their clients to be interviewed in an interview room, and the defense lawyer is like a potted plant over in the corner, and invariably the person confesses to something that they shouldn't be confessing to. But getting back to the point here, when someone is in that situation, and it's perfectly natural in some situations for a suspect to perceive that they're not after the truth. He's not supposed to tell the truth. He's supposed to be part of the inside game. He's in a special position where he stands to better himself. And hey, you're being invited to play the game, just like you see in the movies and just like you see on TV. Now, the way it gets reviewed in court is, well, he was advised of his rights, and why would somebody ever confess to something they didn't do? And that just doesn't match with reality. And the fact that we don't adequately compensate for the psychological pressures that apply here.
It's the same reason why people might plead guilty to things that they didn't do. Because if you stack the deck and you charge somebody with all kinds of charges, you know, charge stacking or whatever they call it nowadays, then you plead guilty to something that's lesser so that you can avoid the potential punishment that you would get if you, in fact, didn't enter into that to that plea agreement. So there are reasons for this all the time. False confessions are something that happens on a fairly regular basis, and we've got documentation of that all over the place.
Earlier this week, on the 5th of December, the Huffington Post reported publishing of a new report put out by the Human Rights Watch Group. And the report did a survey of trends that are occurring in federal court. And much like what we were just talking about, the report indicates a very significant increase in the number of people that are pleading guilty in federal cases. One might say this is a result of better investigations or targeting those who are truly guilty as opposed to not prosecuting those who aren't. But it can also be attributed to, and I think it's more accurately attributed to, the trend that we've seen since 1980. And I'll get to some statistics in a minute here. But since 1980, we've seen several changes in criminal procedure and how cases are prosecuted. First of all, we've had many laws that have increased maximum penalties, but also have imposed mandatory minimum penalties in certain situations. Some of those mandatory minimum penalties include life in prison without parole. A lot of people may not know this, but the decision as to who spends life in prison without parole and who spends 3 years in prison oftentimes, well, every time, comes down to the decision of the prosecutor. And this is one of the major criticisms of mandatory minimum penalties. And you hear me gripe about this all the time, Casey, you're probably sick of it. But essentially, it's one of those situations where legislators get together, they decide that they can score some easy political points by having that vaguely anonymous bad guy out there, the hypothetical person that is engaging in bad stuff. The bad guy goes
the guy with the scruffy beard and the funky glasses.
Right. The guy
the
that, that doesn't may or may not exist. But by applying the law, and here's what happens. If the prosecutor can charge an offense that carries a mandatory minimum penalty, the prosecutor is the only one in that process that can amend the charge. Oftentimes, well, I'm going to say it again, almost every time, that's based on a person's, number one, willingness to cooperate and testify against others. Didn't we just see that in the last story that we covered? Or, secondly, by accepting responsibility and not going to trial, the person can negotiate with the prosecutor to take that mandatory minimum off the table. What this system does not account for, and this is a travesty of justice, is that someone who is innocent is put in a catch-22 situation where they have to make a decision about whether or not they're going to roll the dice. And when every message that you're receiving, let's say you're represented by the federal defender's office. Not somebody that you picked as a lawyer, not somebody that you went out and hired, but that's all you can afford is somebody who has been appointed. Now, federal defenders are excellent attorneys, but the natural process of having somebody that you didn't pick represent you, combined with the fact that federal prosecutors are armed with massive resources. The amount of money they spend on each individual case is astronomical. Millions are spent on some cases, and I've seen it, and that's not an exaggeration. And when a person is perceiving that this is a system whereby you just have to cut your losses and not challenge your case. But here's the problem. If we look at it statistically, going back to 1980, the percentage of federal drug defendants, and drug cases are where these things typically arise, the percentage of people who pleaded guilty was slightly more than 60%, so a majority. But as of 2012, the data that was gathered by the Human Rights Watch Group indicates that less than 3% of drug defendants in federal cases chose to go to trial. Of those 3%, 89% were found guilty. Okay. Now, you may say that, you know, that just seems to indicate that the system's working because 89% is a pretty good conviction rate for those that are choosing to go to trial. And that means, hey, a whopping 11% of those that went to trial were found not guilty. So the system works. I disagree, because I do not think the number of people that are being accused of crimes is a smaller percentage of innocent people, because we're charging more and more people under more and more laws, under more and more theories of prosecution. So on the one hand, we have increases in resources that go towards prosecuting these types of offenses. We have more tools in the toolbox of the prosecutor that takes that power away from the judge to consider things such as the circumstances of the offense, the person's motivation, or for that matter, it bypasses the entire system whereby guilt or innocence can be found. Now, I'm sure there are some prosecutors out there listening right now that think I'm twisting this all around and that sort of thing, but I will tell you that dealing with a defendant who is faced with that choice, more often than not, the defendant is much more concerned about getting some control over the situation rather than seeking the truth. And the amount of courage and faith that you would have to have in the system that the jury is going to get it right. 12 people you've never met before are going to be brought in, and they're going to listen to the prosecutor's attempts to attack you. And the conclusion that that is not a battle worth fighting, albeit an innocent person, is absolutely disgusting to me. And we need to do something. Casey, we
absolutely
need to do something to change these mandatory minimums, to not allow the prosecutions to determine the penalty. And that's what happens almost always in federal court. The prosecutor decides what the penalty is going to be based on whether the person pleads guilty or not. Doesn't that sound like the Star Chamber or something going back to the medieval era? So we don't see it when we create these laws, but this is the fallout. When it goes down the path of actual implementation, we see profound problems.
Well, Kirk, I completely agree. We'll talk about Charles Manson next. Not exactly lightening the mood, but we'll talk about Charles Manson next. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
I'm Kirk O'Bear.
Kirk, I want to talk about hybristophilia. Do you know what this is? This is a very, very interesting thing. Okay.
I'm ready to be educated.
It is a paraphilia, according to Wikipedia, of the predatory type in which sexual arousal an attainment of, well, something related to sexual arousal that I don't want to say in the air, are responsive to and contingent upon being with a partner known to have committed an outrage, cheating, lying, known infidelities, or crimes such as rape, murder, or armed robbery. It's also known as Bonnie and Clyde syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, there are very famous examples of this hybristophilia. The large amount of women attracted to Ted Bundy after his arrest.
Was it really a large amount of women?
According to these sources, it is. And he often drew scores of women at the jammed courtrooms of his trials each day. Jeffrey Dahmer, now deceased, but a serial killer, as we know from the great state of Wisconsin, is said to have had women sending him letters, money, and other gifts during his time in prison. Charles Manson groupies, as Kirk, you well know. There are causes related to this as well, but this has sort of been speculation on why, you know, people are attracted to this.
I'm only being a little facetious here. But isn't it true that we all sort of do the same thing when they make movies about Bonnie and Clyde,
and
then they sort of glorify the whole thing in a way that we are fascinated by it? I mean, I'm not a woman, and I'm not. You may not know this because you only hear my voice on the air, but I'm not a woman, and I'm not interested in dating Chuck Manson either. But you know, the point
you
is
call him Chuck on a first name basis.
Charlie.
Is this, okay.
Chaz.
Yeah. Well, let me just explain, because this isn't just relegated to women. There are also men. And although Casey Anthony was acquitted, she is apparently, while she was incarcerated, got many letters from
fan mail.
Yes, fan mail. So one of the things about this, Kirk, is that this came into the news because Charles Manson is reportedly getting married to a 25-year-old woman named Star, he's named Star. And this woman apparently believes that Charles Manson has been wrongfully imprisoned for the last 40 years and that she is attracted to him. Now, there are lots of different causes for this, and I've read up on this stuff. Some psychologists believe that the reason for this is because the women who go after these men, or men who have to go after these women, are insecure in some way, and they believe because oftentimes the men or women are in prison for the rest of their lives to have committed these crimes, that it's a safe relationship, right? Because they have control over the relationship.
That makes sense.
They have control, right? They have control over the person because they want to avoid relationships where they don't have that control. And if somebody's sitting in prison for the rest of their life, the relationship is totally on their terms. They can then go and visit them, and we'll talk about conjugal visits in a moment, but we don't have them in Wisconsin, if you're wondering. But there are six other states that still have conjugal visits, so you can go and have romantic relations with the person who's...
You can make romance,
yes. Yeah. That's the best way of saying it. So I think it has a lot to do with that, but you're right, Kirk. Bonnie and Clyde syndrome has also to do with, this being romanticized, because on television we see people who want to go after the bad guy, right?
You know, it doesn't occur to me that it's all that surprising, because we do have elements of our society that are, you know, decidedly antisocial for the sake of being antisocial, you know. And this kind of falls in that category, you know, people that are have alternative lifestyles and do things just to shock others and identify with something that is controversial or unusual. We've had that since the history of humankind. But the thing that strikes me as interesting about this particular type of phenomenon, and you describe it as though it's a condition or a disease, but it may just be that there are certain people out there, as you suggest, are comfortable with a relationship that they can have on their own terms. They don't have to worry about where the person is or what they're doing and if they have trust issues and that sort of thing. And hey, let's face it, a lot of us deal with those types of issues psychologically, mentally, at some point in our lives. And, you know, it might be something as simple as a woman being burned or scorned from a previous relationship and deciding she wants nothing to do with that. So add to that the fact that they'll write up an article in the newspaper and jokers like you and me will talk about them. Well, hey, you know, they're getting a lot of attention and they're engaging in something that, you know, you can – become more famous than just however famous you'd be by having a name like Star, wherever that gets you.
Well, I think Charlie gave her that nickname.
Oh, that might be
so.
It.
Yeah, it's
why didn't he choose Swastika?
I don't know. It's very interesting that way. But you know, this whole thing is, you know, you remember Joran van der Sloot, the guy who was the prime suspect in the 2005 disappearance of Natalie Holloway.
Correct.
Remember that being talked about all over the case. So this is something that there's examples of in popular culture. Others believe that this attraction to and wanting to marry people who are serving life sentences has to do with the belief that some of the and most of the stories are about women, so I'll just refer to women here, believe that they can change the man into something that that he was not convicted of. You know, where a lot of people believe that, you know, somebody in prison might be a serial killer. You know, we're talking about the worst examples, right?
Right.
And they believe that they can change them. Or they see the little boy that once was. They see right. Charlie when he was a young boy.
Chuck is misunderstood.
Right.
He's just misunderstood.
Right. And others, there have been studies that have shown that others hope to get fame, including book deals, including movie deals and things like that.
Well, what about the person who's serving the sentence? Don't we attach any responsibility to that person? Because a lot of them are notorious manipulators. You know,
right.
The fact that Ted Bundy was able to do all the things he did, and probably even more so Jeffrey Dahmer, by luring people from, you know, the nightclub into his... He was able to manipulate police into believing that the naked young Filipino boy that was running down the street, it was just a lover's quarrel of
with
some sort.
With a hole
sort.
In his head.
With a hole
yes.
in his head.
Yes.
Some sort of lover's quarrel. Yeah. I mean, if he's able to manipulate the situation such as that, all it takes is, you know, one point of contact, one address, one place
well,
that someone could send a letter and they could start working that system.
Well, and this is something where, I segue into conjugal visits because it's something people ask about all the time. We don't have them in Wisconsin. They don't have them in the federal system. There are six states that still allow for conjugal visits, and one of them happens to be California. So New York is also one of them as well. But a conjugal visit is basically it's not all about sex necessarily. It can be something where it's up to, you know, anywhere from a few hours up to 72 hours. And I think in Canada they allow conjugal visits, if I'm not mistaken. The idea behind that is not so that the inmate just gets to have sexual relations. The idea is that it actually creates more safety in the prison system because it provides an incentive for somebody to behave themselves.
A great reward.
It's a great reward. Also, the idea behind it originally was to promote this family bonding and to promote the stability of the family, because as we know, the stability of the family has a lot to do with whether somebody goes out and has, you know, recommits a crime.
Right.
And so this provides for that, because oftentimes, most of the time, people who are in the prison system are ultimately going to be released back into society.
Let me ask you about a general question, and I don't know how you feel about this, but starting in the early 1900s, there was a trend in our corrections philosophy that we should do more to promote the cooperation of inmates by providing some form of quality of life. It's been controversial and continues to be controversial over the years, because the way that you do that is by providing amenities that your average John Q. public on the street would probably be offended to learn that people are being treated not inhumanely in the system. But what do you think about that, Casey? Is that a good move? Is that something that is a good trend in our system? Are we depriving the public of its sense that people are being punished when they find out that there is the possibility of some form of amenity?
Well, first of all, people who are in prison are... they're not having a good time. Okay, I mean, when you've had your freedom taken away, and all this talk of, oh well, they get to watch TV in some prisons and things like that. I mean, when you have your freedom taken away, that is not a fun time. Whether you've got a library book to read or you don't, and so this idea that we need to treat people like dogs if they are in prison, or like animals if they are in prison, by you know, some suggest, you know, torturing people and things like that. That is, first of all, just inhumane, number one. But number two, if the goal of prison is ultimately that most of the people in there are going to get out at some point in their lives. And if the goal is to have them be productive members of society, and we don't have any rewards for them, and these are simple rewards, like, you know, getting to go to the prison library and, you know, getting to potentially earn time off your sentence by behaving in a good way in prison, by showing that you can go through programs in prison, like, you know, reading and studying and things like that, so that you become good members of society once you're released. That's a good thing for society. That's not a bad thing for society. And so the idea that we'd want to get rid of that, and we have gotten rid of that in most sectors in most prison populations.
Well,
today,
in our own state,
Wisconsin,
we've eliminated the possibility of working your sentence off or behaving or getting treatment that's provided to you within the system and have that having an impact on your sentence.
So what is that going to do for society? That's going to create terrible things for society. It's going to increase crime, not decrease crime. And do we really want to do that?
Hold that thought, Mr. Hoff.
All right.
We're going to have to take another break, but we'll be right back to continue the discussion. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk. Let's just continue their discussion. If you're just joining us, we've been having a not so much a debate, but we're setting it up, trust me, for a controversial subject, how we treat inmates in the prison system. Casey has suggested that providing amenities, providing incentives are a good thing because ultimately most of these people will be back out on the streets, back in society. Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate for just a minute here. And you have to understand, I don't personally believe this, but I want to state the opinion that I've heard from many people. And that is that the justice system is more than just processing an individual, determining their sentence, and then moving on to the next phase of whatever. Because there are people that are victims of violent crime. There are people whose lives have been altered forever. And at a minimum, although the victim in a situation like that does not get to determine the sentence, at a minimum, they should have the understanding of what the sentence is. And again, I'm not saying that this is necessarily an opinion that I espouse, but the argument can be made that we're not asking much if we simply want the public to know that prison is not a place where people have fun, and that it's not necessarily an injustice if when someone is sentenced to a certain period of time in prison, that those who participated in the process know exactly how long the person's going to be there. In Wisconsin, we call it truth in sentencing. And the idea behind that is that when a sentence of, say, 4 years of initial confinement is ordered, they know, the victim knows, the prosecutor knows, the judge knows, everybody knows, it's going to be every day of 40 years, not a day less, not a day more. And the philosophy behind that comes from a number of disappointed factions who learned over the years that a sentence of 10 years may in fact only be 1 year, based on the fact that once a person is turned over to the Department of Corrections, they then handle it from there. They make their own parole determinations. They make their own rules within the system. Now, I'm not saying that it's a good idea to view the system in such a way that the victim of a crime or the prosecution completely has control over the situation, because what that would do is it deprives the court and the public of the opportunity to have faith that each case in and of itself will stand on its own, and that we don't categorize people as murderers, sex offenders, drunk drivers, whatever the case may be. Now, the crime that one commits certainly can define the person, but what about that person out there that has led a good, long life, community service, helping others, children, faithful marriage, and has a bad day, does something out of character for that person? And sometimes it can be a very bad thing, but sometimes not. Sometimes it can be a mistake, you know? And our system is such that there is a tendency, by the virtue of the way that it works philosophically, that that person then is defined by that one act that they committed, and everything else they did is erased. Now, when that happens, that's kind of the view that occurs in court, and it becomes somewhat myopic because we look at what the person is convicted of and the sense of community outrage that's involved there. Now, don't you think, although it helps the Department of Corrections and although it helps the prison system to provide these incentives, there's a problem. There's a fallout from that as well. Because you know what happens when legislators hear from their constituents that people are being treated well in prison? You know what happens? We get laws that make it so that's not possible anymore, and they start tinkering with things. They start making it so there are mandatory minimums, like I was just griping about before. They start making the laws tougher. They start taking discretion away from the judges. And they start eliminating programs that the legislators perceive are being lenient in some way. So although I agree with you, there are those out there that would say what we're really doing is creating a process that will fold in upon itself and implode if we go too far. For example, if Thanksgiving dinner is a free-range organic turkey with all the trimmings and you get to invite guests and, you know, there's shortly after that there's Christmas carols and gifts from Santa Claus, there is an argument that the public deserves to know that people are not living normal lives when they're in prison.
Well, and I know you're playing devil's advocate, but to say that somebody's living a normal life when they're confined, you know, against their own will, when they're behind metal bars in a prison cell, when they have to sleep on, you know, these are not nice mattresses that we get to sleep on. These are not nice conditions that you have to be in. These can cause a person to go crazy while they're sitting.
Okay,
there.
While you're saying that, and I understand exactly what you're saying, but again, I'm being the devil's advocate here. It's a little uncomfortable. I feel a little bit like a wolf in sheep's clothing, or a sheep in wolf's clothing, I should say. But what about this? There are people in the military that are deployed overseas that are living in far worse conditions. And when we do something special for those people, we send, Tim McGraw or somebody like that goes out and has Thanksgiving dinner with the troops where they've got real food, not out of a little bag, and they're able to have a sense of that glimmer of the life they used to know. And these are people that are honorably serving their countries, willing to sacrifice their lives for our freedom, so to speak, and that we are honoring them by giving them this little treat, okay? Why is it automatic that somebody in prison would be treated the same way?
Well, they're not treated the same way.
But let me just point this out. It's a rare occurrence that somebody has any luxury whatsoever in Afghanistan or Iraq.
And you know what? God bless our soldiers and you as a military man for doing what you've done, because I consider people who have served to be heroes. Okay. Do you think that people consider folks who are in prison to be heroes? No, they don't. Society doesn't. And, you know, I understand why, because they've committed a crime, most of them, unless you're innocent.
It's just that we as a society are not capable of giving more than just an occasional thank you to our troops that are overseas.
But the point is, that's an apples and oranges comparison. First of all, people who are in the military, God bless him, other than the draft,
or her,
1968, volunteer to go into the military. And you know, as a result of going into the military, that you're going to lose certain freedoms that you have. You can't do certain things that you otherwise would be able to do. A person who's sitting in a prison cell is there against their will. And I would suggest to you that we are not treating them in any good way whatsoever. We've taken away any incentives for them to reduce their sentences. We give them shoddy meals. We sentence them to longer terms of incarceration than any other country on earth, industrialized or non-industrialized countries. So the idea that somebody is sitting there and they're getting some sort of special treatment or privilege is the wrong way to look at it.
Let me put it this way, just to see if this changes your perspective in any way. And I'm just trying to push you to see if you push back.
It won't. It won't change.
All right. I'm just trying to see if I can get your goat and get you to lose your cool.
You've already done
maybe
that.
Maybe throw something. I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to get there. I'm pushing. But anyway, where do we get the funding for troops to eat meals ready to eat, otherwise known as MREs, for a year at a time that is the crappiest food you can possibly imagine eating? Where does that get
paid? Tax dollars.
Okay. And we know that when they get some extra books or magazines or maybe, you know, a nice television for the troops to watch, that's either donated or where else does it come from?
Tax dollars.
Okay. Yes. Who pays for the conjugal visit vans in California? Who pays for the books that are in the libraries? Who pays for all of the amenities that the people in prison are receiving?
Okay, we do. But who
tax
pays,
dollars.
Who pays if the person doesn't get some sort of incentive, they don't reform themselves, they don't become a better citizen, they don't get out and have a stable family, and then they go and commit more crimes? Who pays for that? Who
well,
pays
we all
for their
do.
Prosecution? We do. So the point is, in the long run, if you have some of these incentivized programs, in the long run, it benefits society in general because it reduces crime. We know that. There are studies that show that. It reduces crime. It reduces recidivism. It creates a more stable society. It creates a society that has more stability in the family. We know the family structure is extremely important. And so in the end, there are reasons. We're not just giving these things. And by the way, I know you're not making it sound like this, but some people make it sound like, you know, it's a Ruth's Chris steak dinner that they're getting. It isn't. It isn't. It's the worst possible food.
Well, you know,
can get.
If you heard of Club Fed in Minnesota, they have a chow hall that
did
is
you say Club Fed.
Yeah. There is a. It's called Sandpoint Federal Correctional Institution, and it is actually a very nice place to stay. And I'm not going to make it seem like it's a dream vacation or anything, but, you know, our tax dollars do go to fund better than average meals and better than average facilities. They're clean. They're nice. There's gym equipment. There's entertainment facilities. There's musical instruments. There's all kinds of things. And it's better than Boy Scout camp in some of these places.
Wow. Well, you're making that sound okay.
I almost convinced myself, but of course not completely. But
yeah. Well, this has been another edition of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Unfortunately, we're out of time for today, but you can join us every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL. Have a wonderful weekend.